Today's topic is the time of the end. And Brother Bob Grant.
We thank our host, Brother Mark, who's been taking very good care of us. We miss seeing Sister Ella and the children. And not that Brother Mark isn't okay to have as our host, but on a more serious note, we miss the presence of our dear Brother Paul. I first met Brother Paul when I went to the first time I went to a convention at Indiana. Brother Raffle and Brother... I had a tape recorder with me, so guess where I was? Up in the balcony at IU and at the auditorium. And there I met Brother Alvin Raffle and Brother Paul Brown. And it was quite a nice experience for my first time being in the Midwest. And I rode out in the car with Brother David Duran, Brother Norman and Sister Woodworth, and it was quite an experience. I won't tell you the whole story. We bring you love from your brethren at New Brunswick, from our children out there, Jonathan and Becky and their children, of course, and Jordan and Bethany. On the way in this morning, I found out that I had a call coming in from Australia, wonder of cell phones, huh? From Brother Nohan Harsha, who visited this area some time ago and who wanted his love conveyed to you, and some personally, who he had met and spent some time with. He is the brother-in-law of our brother Varma, and brother Nohan is very, very earnestly a guardian of the truth, as we understand it from Brother Russell. He's a blessing to us to fellowship with in the Spirit. There are a lot of preliminaries I want to just take time to express to you. In a sense, what we have to say to you is in Volume 3, and also in the handout, the manuscript that you were given. Of course, we will probably fill in some other thoughts as well. Brother Mark suggested you have a chance to look at it later. You will, in fact, during the service. We will refer to it. So if you just remember that, we're going to be digging into it fairly soon. The other thing is we realize that there are many, many blessings that we personally have. And as I look around the room, I thank the Lord for having known many of you for many, many years, and the privilege of learning from you and from some family members that are not represented in your families, who we love and who have gone on before. So this is a very special time to see your faces and to think about the joys we've shared together and the opportunities we've had. This all started back many years ago when we heard some other thoughts being presented at another convention somewhere else on Daniel 11, and we prepared a discourse on it. And since that time, brethren have asked us for copies of the handout that was prepared. And then after that, it was encouraged, actually, I don't want to mention any names, but his initials are David Duran, encouraged us to pursue the, to pursue the matter. And we were very thankful for that opportunity, and it's taken quite a bit of time and quite a bit of editing, and what you see isn't perfect, believe me. And so if you have any comments or any suggestions, you know, contact us, because we would like to clean up whatever's out there that, you're going into print's a dangerous thing. It's sort of there, and you can't get rid of it. So you'll forgive the mistakes, and let me know about them, if you will. And there are mistakes. Daniel 11 stands as a bridge, and that's why we entitled this Crossing the Bridge from Daniel's Time, Arriving at the Time of the End. So really the title of the discourse is not the time of the end. Sorry, Brother Mark. It's Crossing the Bridge from Daniel's Time, Arriving at the Time of the End. And it's a verse-by-verse analysis of Daniel 11, at least the manuscript is. And our discourse, we'll touch in a little bit with that. I have to pause again in terms of crossing bridges. As we speak, Sister Tamara and Sister Yulia from Siberia are on the Trans-Siberian Railroad in a five-day railroad trip across to see their brethren in Moldova. Please pray for them. Sister Julia has not been well, and she's venturing out on this five-day trip on a clunkety-clunk train going across Siberia. So please remember her. I mean, there's just no relinquishing this journey. It's just incredible. So pray for them. Let's go back to our subject. Arriving at the time of the end. The prophecy of Daniel 11 is a bridge from ancient Israel's past to the time of the end times. And end time prophecy has really three special places and sources. The book of Daniel, Jesus' prophecy as recorded principally in Matthew 24, and of course the book of Revelation. That's not to leave out the fact that there are other prophecies in the Old Testament and some expressions in the New Testament that can be found regarding end times. After John wrote the revelation down as dictated to him, because it is, after all, not John's revelation, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ, and after he wrote it down, the brethren spent a great deal of time pondering what he wrote. So, in a sense, it's really been a challenge for the earnest Bible seeker to try to understand what prophecies in Daniel, even, because he refers back to Daniel's prophecy and the Lord's great prophecy, and what these end times would all mean. From Isaac Newton's time forward, there has been really intense study on this by many, many people, many Christians. Now, we'll find that most of them, virtually all of them, had missed some key points. And one of the key points they missed has to do with the understanding of part of the prophecy. And when they focused on that part of the prophecy, several things happened. For some of them, for example, the individuals who thought that the Lord would return at the end of the 1,000 years, to them, because they placed the prophecy regarding the abomination that maketh desolate in the past, in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century B.C., they virtually just ruled out any significance to these prophecies as they might apply in looking for something yet in the future at any time during the age, because they just was ruled out. Didn't matter. But there are other Christians, and going back into the early 1800s with Nelson Darby, and later with Cyrus Schofield, they began to generate an idea of the man of sin, of the desolation, of all these different prophecies, and essentially excluding them from the past, just taking it as an example, and dragging it forward and actually projecting it into the future. The prophecies take a huge jump of thousands of years, and they have these prophecies being fulfilled in what is now yet future, many of them, including parts of Daniel 9. And if you study Daniel 9 as Brother Russell presented it, you recognize that those things which were spoken of Jesus have already occurred. In Daniel 9:24, particularly, as an example. And I think what we have to do is recognize that Daniel 11, as understood by us as a result of Brother Russell's work, is singularly the only correct understanding that I can think of as I scan all of the different little ones that I'm aware of. There, even the Adventists have a slip-up on this, and the writers of Brother Russell's period who were Adventists didn't really follow the real proper track through this period of time. Now, we don't intend to rewrite Volume 3's chapter on Daniel 11, but we do intend to bring in some of the data and details to make it clearer that, verse by verse, we can go through this and get the sense and the meaning of these points and find, with as much enthusiasm as Daniel had for time, what things are important to us. And Daniel was earnest. I mean, we know his prayers for what was going to happen to his people. We should, I think, pray as earnestly that we can face the experiences we're going through and understand the truths that we've been provided with the great and certainly the intense vigor and zeal that he had. So now we come to a period of time in our lives where we are not blind to what the Christian world out there is saying. They are filling the minds of the average person on the street, the average person who walks in, pardon the expression, to Walmart, with all kinds of books and literature of horrifying events that are yet future. Horrifying events. Scary events. We met a man at a nursery one day. Rebecca and I were talking with this man, witnessing a little bit, and he said that he was given a set of those books by his daughter. He put them under his bed. They were frightening. He didn't want anything to do with them. We tried to encourage him. We gave him some literature, and we hope that he got some relief from. We haven't seen him because we don't shop in that area, but the point is that people are being horrified by what they're being told about God's intentions for this world. Now, there is a popular view, of course, that this Antiochus Epiphanes was just a prototype, and that what he did by literally defiling the temple in Jerusalem is going to be followed up by, in the future, a man of sin coming, defiling the temple, in a temple that's going to be built in Jerusalem, and therefore we have a lot of our Christian friends scurrying about trying to fortify the nation of Israel so that at some time a temple will be built and all of this prophecy can be fulfilled. Almost as if they really have to help God do this. Which, of course, God doesn't intend to do as far as I can tell. And we recognize also that there is a prophecy that really should have given the post-millennialists, that is those who pushed the kingdom off till way, way, way in the future, at the end of some time when they convert the world, which, by the way, is a concept being revived in Christendom, or churchianity, if you prefer, or whatever you want to call that group of people out there who run around in collars backwards and so forth. There is another grouping of them called revisionists, Christian revisionists. Their concept is quite amazing. They are basically Presbyterians who are Orthodox Presbyterians, and their view is that they are winners. They will convert the world. They will do this because Jesus said, "Occupy till I return." So they're waiting for that to happen after they convert the whole world. Now that's a totally separate group. The left behind group is the group that's stirring up the activity, and they're the ones who have the principal misunderstanding of this. You say, "Well, what do we need this for, Brother Bob? We understand Daniel 11. We got it in the volume." This is a kind of a rounding out of some of the details. Brother Russell at one point mentioned that everybody's agreed up to this point, so we're not going to go into any. But really, everybody isn't agreed anymore. It's all over the place now. So we thought we'd fill in a little of those blanks that he didn't have to do in his day, because it wasn't that scattered in his day. And maybe it will be helpful to your personal study as well. Now, we recognize that Jesus made a very critical statement, and that critical statement is this. It's in Matthew 24. Begins in the 14th verse and goes into the 15th. And I'll be reading. "And then shall come the end, when ye therefore shall see the abomination spoken of by Daniel the prophet." And you'll find this, by the way, on page, well, I don't know what the number is, probably 3, but it's the first page inside your book. So if you'll open your books up, you'll find this center bottom, where it's indented. And notice what it says. "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand," which is literally in the dialogue, "having stood in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand, then let them which be in Judea flee to the mountains." Now we understand what Brother Russell means there, but our point of focus here is that "shall" means future. "Shall" does not mean Antiochus Epiphanes fulfilled this. So a large percentage of the Christian world were in a big fog for a long time on this point. Now, granted, the Adventists and certainly Brother Russell did not go in that direction, which we're very thankful for the Enlightenment. But moving ahead, we want to introduce to you, you can turn the page if you have an opportunity, to the part where it talks about the answer to Daniel's prayer. We recognize that Daniel was given several different visions. Vision in Daniel 2. He's interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's vision, rather. The vision in Daniel 7, where you have the beasts coming out of the waters. And then you have more in Daniel 8, where he's given this measure of time of 2,300 days. And you say, well, Daniel was pretty upset about that. Why was he so upset? 2,300 days, that's not such a big issue. And then things will be better, the sanctuary will be cleansed. Well, actually, there was no sanctuary. They had destroyed the temple at that time. Think about it. So 2,300 days, something was confusing in his mind. He couldn't think. He was physically sick. You read the text. He was physically sick as a result of this message. But he also was sick because, not just because it was something that wasn't going to happen for a while, he was sick because he understood the concept of a day for a year. You say, well, how could he do that? Well, remember, Moses left Egypt and went out toward the land of Canaan, and after the spies went out for 40 days, Moses was told 40 years, a day for a year. Ezekiel was contemporary with Daniel, and he was told to lie on his side for 390 days, and then later 40 days. And he was told it's a day for a year. Daniel wasn't completely without knowledge of this. And I think he understood the sense of this, and it made him ill. He knew that things would wait till the time of the end. He was told that, as we know, in other passages. Just as a point of reference, at the bottom of this page, which you're looking at, you'll see that I have the boxes set up in such a way. And when you read about the 70 weeks prophecy, this is just a little detail, it is a part of the 2,300 days. And it's cut out from it, so to speak. On the next page, of course, we see the references to Daniel's other three measures of time, the 1260, 1290, and 1335 days. Now, we recognize from Daniel 2 and 7 especially that there's a period of time that was going to occur when empires would be exchanged one after the other. The head of gold and so forth, silver and copper and so forth. You know, that's quite a spread of history. And it runs through so quickly, gold, silver, and so forth. But Daniel 11 stretches this out. It gives us names, almost, of individuals. It gives us people, segments of kings who will do this and that. And those events did take place. And that's really what's going to happen in the context, which, of course, you will read in Volume 3. Brother Russell put it there for us. There's no question about it. What we've incorporated into this handout is several things. One, specific collections of scriptures that pertain to specific events. References, for example, to the ending of the continual and ever efficacious sacrifice made by Jesus. These points need to be kept in mind because as we understand the study, those people who bypassed the meaning of Jesus' words that there would be an abomination, who thought it was past, missed what was going to happen to the Christian church and how the defiling would take place among God's people. And, of course, Daniel was told that this would all come to a conclusion and there would be a time at the end of the 2,300 days when the sanctuary would be cleansed. Now think about the meaning of that. You know, we talk about the most holy of the tabernacle as being Kodesh Kodeshim. It's the Hebrew for holy of holies. Kodesh Kodeshim. Well, the cleansing of the sanctuary, the making individuals holy, as in Daniel 9, is all a part of this cleansing of the individuals. Cleansing the individuals who are pictured in this condition. Since our goal is to find out how we arrive at the time of the end, we look for key places. And what we find when we're studying Daniel 11 is a very important point. This point about Epiphanies is one of those points. Very critical. You have to understand that it happened, but Jesus said, look for something, which means it wasn't yet ready to be fulfilled. But neither do we want to jump the way some Christians are doing way into the future and say, no, that's yet future, nor look back to 70 AD the way the preterist theologians do and say that all took place at the destruction of the literal temple. So you see you have a stage. Epiphanies, Jerusalem in 70 AD, the true time or sometime future. And it's nice to know that when you're talking to somebody about the truth on these things, that they may be coming from any one of these other places. And you might have to sort out, where are we really in this stream of time with Daniel? Before I get into looking at some of the charts with you, I would like you to notice the structure of the book. So if you look at the bottom of page 5, there is the first verse set up, and you'll notice that on the left side you do have the text, either from the NAS or the NIV, or possibly other translations as well as the King James. The comment is really an interpretive rendering, so to speak, or not a rendering, but an interpretation or an explanation of what's happening in that verse. And you'll find in most of these cases, because it's right from the volume, a lot of details. I've added other details to round out the history that Brother Russell didn't take the time to include, which I believe are consistent. If you'll turn the page to page 6 and 7 and look at them both at the same time, you begin to see the spread, because as this prophecy begins, Daniel is in the days of the Persian kings. I'll repeat. Daniel is standing in the days of the Persian kings, and he's going to be taken through the several kings, prophetically, down to the time when the time of the end would come. So as we look at the second box, Gabriel is talking to them, and he's mentioning these various kings. And then we leave the Persian kings, and we introduce Alexander the Great. If you'll hold your place here, and just turn to the last pages, the last, literally last leaf of the book, you'll see a sideways chart. And if you look at the first side of that, Appendix D, you'll see that we've put here Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and Daniel 8, parallel verses showing how these different kingdoms are described for you in those two other chapters after the Nebuchadnezzar vision. And I think that will be helpful. And again, if you find something wrong, please let me know. I'd really like to have your help. But now go back to our Alexander the Great page, page 6. I wanted you to be able to visualize what it is that is the scope of this empire. Not all of us open up atlases or books to look at maps. I like maps. I'm very friendly to maps, and they're friendly to me, if I bother reading them. In this case, we see the empire of Alexander stretching out all the way to Egypt, from virtually the Western Mediterranean, all the way back to India. And there are stories that are interesting and fascinating about how in the world he managed to conquer the Persians with their huge chariots with scythe blades and the Indians with their elephants. I mean, he managed to do it. He was very successful. But that's for another time. If we go to page 7, notice the bottom of the page in particular. It mentions the north, the west, the east, and the south. That is a brief description for you of what literally happened and who took over these regions. I think it's important to be able to visualize that. So if you turn the page again, you're at page 8, and you will see that you have the various empires as they broke up from Alexander. And when we read the text, we recognize that what he had as an empire did not go to his heirs. Rather, it went to his generals. And that's so logical. If a general is here and a general is there, and they're not all in the same place, unless they scurry off from that, but if they're in different places controlling his empire, they will logically become in command of that area. And usually what happened even in Roman times, you may remember this, that if they found out that an emperor was sick and dying, then they would rally around their particular general, vote for him as the new emperor, and march off to Rome to see if they could get to Rome first. And he would become the emperor. Or they might have to fight it out, I suppose. That's the way it happens sometimes, not always. But that's the sense of what happened. And if you look at this one under the word Saga of Greed and Revenge, you see these four basic sections. Italy was really a part of that. I'm not sure why this map doesn't show it. I didn't draw the map, obviously. But if you know anything about Greek history, Sicily was a Greek colony. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Notice the shaded portion at the bottom of the page. This is a very critical thing as well. When we're reading Daniel 11, we have to remember
that God, through Daniel, is speaking of the north, the king of the north, and the king of the south. It's usually from the perspective of Israel, because as these kings of the north and of the south began to badger each other, they used Israel as the stomping ground, and they ran back and forth across it as if they were wiping their feet, to put it plainly. The Israelites who lived there, and you say, well, what Israelites? There were Israelites there, obviously, through this period. They were waiting for Messiah. This is the period even pre-Maccabees. They didn't have a huge kingdom at this time. They were stomped on by everybody. In other words, if you recall this concept of the times of the Gentiles, they were really trodden down of the Gentiles, literally, physically. They marched their armies back and forth all the time. As you read through this and you see what happens and what develops. Well, let's take, for example, one of the things that develops. There is a king, the second Ptolemy, Ptolemy Philadelphus, or Philadelphus. He has a daughter named Berenice. He gives her as a bride to his rivals, if you will, in the north. The king there is the second Seleucid king. His name is Theos the Second, God the Second. But Theos II was unlike the name of a god. He was quite a weakling, apparently. He had a wife whose name was Laodicea, something like Laodicea. Maybe even it was named after her. I don't know the answer to that. But she was his wife. She had a couple of sons by him, and everything was fine until the Egyptian king, this king from the south, the Ptolemy, sends this bride. Now, politically, as you know, in the days of Solomon, they received brides from small, it was like a diplomatic act. Well, he gets this bride, and he puts this woman aside with her family, and he accepts this new bride. But he gets lonely for the old bride, and he brings her back. Not that she's old, but brings her back. And she's a little too clever for him. She poisons him. She figures he's going to do this again. He's not trustworthy. And then she sets out to have the other bride killed, and the children, all her retinue killed. So now she's in charge. She's got her son Callinicus in charge. And as you can read this, but as you go through this, you begin to realize this is the grit for disaster. I mean, you just killed the daughter of an emperor, so to speak, from the south. What's going to happen next? Well, needless to say, her brother comes back with a vengeance. And you have this incredible saga of greed and revenge. And they march back and forth each other's territories. And that's what happens in the next several verses. And we're not going to read them now. Let's turn a page or two. Let's turn several pages. Let's go down to page 12, if you will. This is a summary. And the summary really is one which gives you an idea of what we just talked about. Alexander's empire is divided, north and south. You have the different sections of it, and you see that there's two basic dynasties that come up. And you can follow through this. I have listed for you the verses, and also the individuals who were principals in those verses. And there, again, maybe errors there. I don't think so. I think this is correct. What happens in verse 14 on the right side of your page, 14a and b, is very critical. Brother Russell is very careful to explain through the reasoning, but when he gets to the second part of verse 14, and this is a crucial part, he interprets this for us that the robbers of the people attempt to establish the vision. That is, they would have put the vision into operation. But that's not what the Lord intended. And so, although he appears to have fulfilled the vision, he really doesn't. But you see, most believing Christians take it for granted that he did, and they stick with this Antiochus line through the entire rest of the book of Daniel, 11th chapter. So what does that tell us? That tells us that without making the jump from Greece, and I shouldn't say Greece really, it's the Hellenistic Empire. You know what the word Greece is in the Greek language? Does anyone know? And I'm pronouncing it wrong, but it's Hellas, H-E-L-L-A-S. That's Greece. If you see a stamp from Greece, it's written Hellas. And that is the name for Greece. So when they speak of Alexander and his generals and the activity of their multicultural concept of society, you're talking about the Hellenistic society. That comes to a, not exactly abrupt end, but it comes to an end when a man named Pompey, P-O-M-P-E-Y, from Rome, invades this area of the King of the North, and essentially takes for Rome the title of King of the North, and at the same time, by deposing this last of the Antiochuses, number 16, he seems to be in a good commanding position. But not to remain there, because there is a gentleman, pardon the expression, named Julius Caesar, who will come on the scene and who will beat up on him, drive him to Egypt, where he is murdered. So Pompey's off the scene almost immediately, and not mentioned, generally speaking. But this is what happened. This is how you make the transition between the Antiochuses and the Romans. Pompey is the intermediary moment. But the scriptures speak about Caesar, and for that matter, about Mark Antony as well. And Cleopatra is part of the story. And that's a lot of story, too, if you really wanted to know about it. But, and some of it's funny, but the rest of it is not very funny at all. We're going to turn the page again. We're on 1415. The reason we're here is, and the reason we introduced this, consider this title, Critical Transition, Rome Enters the Stage, as basically a large division with several subheads under it. Rome doesn't immediately enter here, although we are talking about different aspects of the ideas related to the continual sacrifice being taken away. Let's continue with this concept. Daniel is standing in this little bit of a summary here. Daniel is standing in the days of the kings of Persia. We've gone through the Hellenistic or Greek period. We're now into the period of Rome. It's during the period of Rome that will rise up this abomination that really makes desolate. And the way we make the transition is quite important. And the distinction must also be made that a literal temple was not being spoken of as being cleansed or defiled, for that matter. What was being spoken of was the spiritual. And what happens is in the box at the bottom of page 14. Here's where you have a depiction or a description from the 1992 New Catholic Catechism of what the sacrifice of Christ, the Mass, the Eucharist, are supposed to be. This is your abomination that maketh desolate, and it is one of the things that really needs to be read over carefully, not now, but it is a part of this problem. They take away the ever-efficacious sacrifice. I think we all know they didn't do that. I mean, literally, they can't. But in the minds and hearts of believing Christians, they did. Because if you believed correctly, not the way they were teaching, you could be persecuted to death. And brethren were. And for the other ones who went along with them, what was stolen from them is the ever-efficacious sacrifice, because now they were going through a mental process of believing that they were eating the flesh and blood of Jesus, and that's how they had their, well, not the blood, but the flesh of Jesus. And that's how they had their blessing. Of course, the priests would drink the wine, which they believed was the blood. So it's really tragic, and it does have its literal impact as it was played out in the lives of these Christians throughout the age. Now, let's turn the page, because the raiser of taxes is another important transition. As we come through Daniel 11, we need to have something to take a nail and drive it into the wall and say, this is the point that we can also refer to know we have left the Greeks behind. We are now in a different period. Which, of course, again, a lot of Christians don't do. But we recognize that the raiser of taxes was Augustus. He was the one who followed Caesar. And some of the history of that is listed here, along with the comments. You have where they use pronouns, the names, and this I could have mentioned earlier. So like, for example, he, Julius Caesar, this is verse 20, under raiser of taxes. He, Julius, his Julius Caesar's successor, Augustus, will send out a tax collector. We've kind of tried to build into this the explanation as we went. And we also note that it is during his time and his successor's time that they created what was to be called the Pax Romana. Almost seems like the G7 or whatever their number is now seems to be trying to recreate a Pax Romana of some sort. They want to have this world economic community, which will make everybody happy. Peace everywhere. Let's suppress any anxiety. And so governments are busy at work with their economic policymakers trying to have everybody able to be trading with everybody and make a lot of money for the people who are controlling the boats, the ships of state. Moving on to page 19. Constantine to Justinian. We recognize that Constantine was one of the church's first big problems. It wasn't the only problem. And that Justinian helped move things along in a very significant way. I will mention just briefly, there is a book written by a Mr. Rubinstein, whose name, first name I can't remember, Richard Rubinstein? Yeah. Called, somebody else can remember it. When Jesus Became God. The book is called When Jesus Became God. Not suggesting you run out and buy it. But when I read it, I found what a horrendous bunch of characters were running around in those couple hundred years when they formalized the doctrines in the early church and how they went about doing it. And this Jewish fellow, Richard Rubinstein, managed to put it together quite accurately and unbiasedly, I would say, coming out with, of course, the other fellows, the quote orthodoxy, having it their way, but showing us what a wicked bunch of characters were in charge. Here we have the illustration of the wafer that they use in the Mass. And again, we recognize that this was the Brother Russell's words. If you look at the bottom where it starts, verse 33 on page 19, you see the words right above that? The abomination that maketh desolate is the climax of doctrinal degeneracy. That's essentially Brother Russell's. Well, it really was bad. Next page. You know, the Adventists comprehended this to some extent, but Brother Russell pinned it down in volume 3. From the introduction of this fatal and blasphemous error, it's in that indented paragraph, the Mass, God calls the system an abomination, and its subsequent exaltation to power is here referred to as the desolating abomination setup. Important for us to know where that is, and, you know, we even suggest here, if Luther really understood what this was all about, he probably would not have even come up with the doctrine of transubstantiation, which is another issue. There's examples which you can read in your time. I'd like to point out to you the chart on the page to your right, page 21. There's a couple of things about this that I think are important. One is, it's clearly five chapters with portions that we're concerned about having to do with the daily sacrifice and the wearing out of the saints. But now, notice the two pictures. One is Justinian, and one is his wife, Theodora. This is from a mosaic in Ravenna, in a church. It's the very place where Belisarius defeated the Ostrogoths, who, by the way, were Arian, and enabled the Pope, that is, the Bishop of Rome, to become the Pope, and therefore Justinian throwing his favor with him. By the way, there were other emperors who also threw favor to the Bishop of Rome, but this was a critical time, very critical. I want you to notice the one with Daniel 9 in the first column. You could draw a circle around that, because that is, or mark it in some way. That is a little different from the ones above and below. This one has to do with a different type of sacrifice and oblation, doesn't it? Do you understand what I'm saying? In Daniel 9, this is when the Lord is displeased with the Jewish people for continuing their sacrifices after he has offered Jesus Christ as a sacrifice. So make a little bit of a contrast. You can write contrast in that open space there. I should have done that for you. But this is a place where the sacrifice and oblation is referred to. It's included here, but it's a totally different picture. Daniel 9 is about what the Lord does in his reaction to the Jewish people ignoring Jesus' ever-efficacious sacrifice and trying to continue the sacrifice in the temple. which then was destroyed, literally. I hope I made that clear. It's a very important detail. Okay, let's go on. Enter Napoleon. Now, we've already made... You know what? I shouldn't... Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking for something that I skipped over. Yeah, I did. just as another point, you might wonder, if you go back just a few moments, go back to page 18. There's a reference to Aurelian. When you're studying this, you'll notice Aurelian seems to be coming out of nowhere. But there's a very critical point, it's verse 27. Put a little star there. This is an early indication of the cooperation of church and state desired by both, that is, to work together. The Roman emperors wanted peace at any cost. They wanted a successful empire, Pax Romana. And the church wanted the help of the emperors. And there's a very interesting story about Zenobia and a man named Paul of Samosata. You can read about Paul of Samosata in Brother Russell's writings. He was a character. He didn't believe the way the Orthodoxy did in the, quote, Trinity that was being formed. But at the same time, he was a little too pompous. He wouldn't let his parishioners sing hymns to Jesus because he was just a man who had the Logos added to him. It's really weird. He wanted them to sing praises to him. But anyway, that's another story. Let's go back where we were. Napoleon. The reason we mention Napoleon, of course, is that this is the critical point. No one brings us to Napoleon, as does Brother Russell in describing this event, and brings us to the time when Napoleon's efforts will come to fruition in terms of his activities. And there are several levels of activity that Napoleon's involved in. One is the activity of going into Italy and taking control of the Vatican and having his people take away the Bishop of Rome. As you know from Brother Russell's writings, those battle-hardened soldiers were horrified when they found what the papal inquisition-type folk were doing in different parts of the world. And recently there have been things in the press about this new pope. He's the former head of what used to be called the Inquisition. Interesting position to be in as Pope. But the point is that they're all talking about the Inquisition as being, oh, that was some of the people out there, they were doing, that wasn't nice. As if the church is not responsible for what its monasteries and other things are doing. It's amazing. Well, let's follow this through to its conclusion. The Napoleon story is principally this. Napoleon comes on the scene. He is active in suppressing what Rome did. He is active in elevating human rights. He takes what is called Code Napoleon and spreads it throughout Europe. He invigorates nationalism, oddly enough, I don't know if he intended to, in other countries, such as by forming the Germanic League, of the Confederation of the Rhine, as it was called. And if you put all these little pieces together, you realize that this man is extremely resistant to anybody else's opinion. He rode on a ship to Egypt, planning a conquest of the East, rallying Jewish people to his side to try to establish a Jewish homeland. Appendix B, when you have a chance later, is about that. It's his words. And the strangest thing happens, this man actually was, as it was historians record, this man was actually thinking, as he read through the Quran heading towards Islamic countries, that he, once he had conquered this, would create his own religion and write his own book. Mohammed did it, why not? You can quote me. Napoleon is discussed in these verses. You can read them in detail. But basically what he did was make for us the conclusion of this bridge to the time of the end. He brings the papal system to its knees. He, of course, the Pope dies in captivity, so to speak, at this time. But then, of course, he makes this reversal. And to gain popularity and to gain control, he begins with the Concordats and works with these religious leaders. But you know, we were looking for the time of the end. And we find the time of the end described as being the portion where Napoleon is active. That brings us to 1799. That brings us to the beginning of the time of the end. And then from that period on stretches out the activities of some of the verses of chapter 12, the 1290 and the 1335 days, specifically. During that time, Michael stands up for the people of Israel. We see that the great time of trouble would begin, such as never was upon a nation. And another sign, the many running to and fro. All of these part of what happens during the time of the end. And finally, the knowledge shall be increased, in fact, as never before. Such enormous amounts of information are being transmitted. We understand that the time of the end is really merely a preparation. A preparation for the time of beginning. Think about that. We come to the time of the end, and yet the time of the end is the preparation for the time of beginning. And the blessings that will flow in the kingdom will be as a result of restoring in reality to all mankind that which was stolen, that ever efficacious sacrifice of Jesus was removed by the false system. And now the world of mankind and the kingdom will have the blessing of receiving that. It is then that the world will know what we now know, that we've arrived at the time of the beginning. We would solicit your questions, but I see our chairman is here, and unless he wants me to take a question, I'll stop.